Sometimes as leaders, we can feel like we have to have all the answers, but I don't know if you've realized, but young people's questions are getting harder and harder to answer. And so you actually don't have to have all the answers. You just have to be willing to journey with people and work it out together. You know, they're not impressed by your knowledge. They're probably more impressed by how you treat them, more impressed by your authenticity, and more impressed by your honesty.
Welcome to another episode of Leadership Conversations with Nikki Gumbel. Today we have Isaac Borkwe, better known as Governor B, sitting down with Nikki and Pippa, and it's a really interesting conversation. The three of them cover a number of different themes, including what caused Isaac to choose Jesus over a life of crime, how to create safe spaces for the next generation, and Isaac's recommendation on how all of us can respond to the realities of inequality in our world. I'll hand it off to Nikki to introduce Isaac.
I am thrilled that today we're here with Isaac Borkwe, better known as Governor B. Isaac has become a great friend. He's part of the team here at HTB, and we've had the opportunity. Actually, we've known each other for many years, but since he's been on the team at HTB, we've had lots of walks around Hyde Park together. We've had lots of chats, and he's made a massive contribution to the life of HTB. He is a MOBO award-winning artist, broadcaster, doing lots of stuff right now on Sky Sports, and often being interviewed about culture, about music on BBC and other broadcasting channels. He's the author of two books, including his most recent book, Unspoken, Toxic Masculinity and How I Face the Man Within the Man. And I read this book. I don't often read books. When I read most books, I skim through them, but I did actually read every word of this book. And you can see it's got a well-thumbed spine because I found it a really interesting book, and he writes so well. And I've been recommending it on my Instagram. I've been recommending it because I think it's a very important book, actually, and well worth reading. I think it's interesting that the people who've endorsed this book, Zoe Ball, Benjamin Zephaniah, and George the Poet on the front page, is a revealing and relatable memoir. And it really is kind of like the story of your life. And that's really what we want to ask you about, just to draw out from you your life story, because it's a fascinating one. And start with your parents. And because you had in your household growing up, I think you spoke three languages.
Yeah, so my parents are from Ghana. They moved over to England in their early 20s. My dad speaks Ga, which is a Ghanaian dialect. My mum speaks Twi, which is her dialect. And then we also spoke English. So they would often speak the Ghanaian dialects in the household. I didn't speak it as well, but I kind of picked it up and understood a lot of that. But yeah, I'm a first generation Brit. We grew up on a council estate in East London. It was an area called Custom House. And I loved my upbringing. We didn't have much as a family, but we had a lot of love, and my parents were really hard workers. And yeah, I didn't realize that we lacked anything until I got a bit older and I looked back and I was like, oh, that's why we maybe didn't always eat together and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I had a great upbringing.
What was the estate like?
The estate was full of people like us, first generation Brits, but also, you know, working class English people. There were various nationalities, you know, people from Africa, people from Asia, all over Europe. And we were all very different, but it was almost like our differences made us realize that we were all the same. It was the thing that we had in common. And it was an estate of love. There was, you know, what you often get in working class communities, the crime and the violence and the gang activity. But if you're on the estate, you kind of feel like you're part of a family. It was in, and I'm making myself sound quite old here, I'm not that old, but it was in those days, those good days where your neighbors had as much right to tell you off as your parents did. And it was a real village feel about the community.
And where did the name Governor B come from?
So me and my friends had these tag names that we'd call ourselves on the way to school, and we felt like we were a little army. So I was the governor, another one of my friends was lieutenant, another one was general.
Why were you the governor?
Because I like to make the decisions. No one listens. I like to make the decisions, and I didn't know I would become a rapper. If I did, I would have picked a better rap name. But it just stuck. Did you guys have any tag names or nicknames growing up?
Nothing as cool
as
that.
We weren't as interesting as you.
No, sadly not. So when you were at school, something happened when you were seven. I believe you had an encounter with your head teacher.
Yeah, Miss Arnonson pulled me into her office after I'd got sent out of English class. And I thought she was going to tell me off like she always does. But she kind of said to me, look, you don't understand how good you are at English and how good you are at writing stories and putting words together. You're really amazing at this. And if you were to apply yourself and really concentrate in class, you're going to do really well. And for me, even though my parents were really loving, they were such hard workers that they didn't always have time to tell me what I was good at. They were just focused on, you know, making rent that month and that kind of stuff. But Miss Arnonson was the first person in my life that told me that you're good at something and you can aspire to something. And I guess up until that point, I just kind of let the days go by. But I walked out of her office kind of 6 feet tall thinking I'm good at English. And that's when I started to concentrate in class. And lo and behold, my job now is putting words together. So that investment and that inspiration she gave me went a long way.
Amazing, really, that at seven she recognised you, because you write so well. You know, this book is so well written. It's like you have a natural gift with words and your songs, and so it's extraordinary that she, age seven, and the fact that she said that to you had such an impact on you.
I think the remarkable thing is in our community, it's littered with young people that have potential. But because life can throw its curveballs, they're not always equipped with the best tools that they need to thrive in life. And so a lot of teachers can often, you know, write us off and think, oh, they're not really applying themselves. They're probably not going to do that well. But with Miss Arnonson, she always treated every single individual like they were important and like they weren't a lost cause. And I think the fact that she didn't give up on me, it was amazing. And it definitely helped the trajectory of my life.
But you think that one comment, I wonder whether she knows that comment had such an impact.
Maybe she listens to your music, does she?
Yeah, she keeps telling me that I rap too fast, so I need to get it done. She's in her early 80s and we email every now and again. And she's been a great influence in my life.
But it shows the power of words, doesn't it? That one comment to you. And you think what an impact you can have now with one comment to someone, to a young person.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, reading the Bible, I'm aware that there's life and death in the power of the tongue. And you can take from that various things. But a way in which that Bible verse has come to life is I see how much words have an impact on young people and the amount of positivity and the amount of inspiration and encouragement that they receive from very young is truly important to where they go next. And so, words are super important.
So interesting. And I guess reading your book, you kind of had a choice when you were growing up. It was guns or Jesus.
Yeah, it was. I think I feared my parents more than I feared anything else. So that always kind of helped me in the sense of not getting too deep into a lifestyle that has very serious repercussions. But there are a lot of things that happened on the estate that were normalized. And so, for example, at 11 years old, I saw my first gun on the estate and someone handed it to me, kind of like, oh, wow, look at this. And in the moment, I didn't really understand the seriousness of what I was handling. It was just so normal. But with the gun in my hand, I just knew straight away it was like this. I don't know whether it was the fear of my parents. I don't know whether it was the Holy Spirit. I just knew that this life isn't for me and this is not the way that I want to go. And I've seen the results of what happens when you go down this route in life and I just didn't want that for myself. But a few years later, I just thought back to that time and I thought it's scary that, you know, an 11-year-old can be handed a gun on the estate and not bat an eyelid. And so I think it gave me more impetus to want to put out positive messages through my music and be an alternative in the area and show people like a relatable role model or a relatable way to be positive in life and make better decisions.
And when did you start doing music and what journey did you go on?
I'm kind of embarrassed to share this, but I started in year 9 at school by a rap battling in the middle of the playground, saying some not very nice things about people's mothers, very, very rude stuff. And I was always quite good at it. And so I've got a bit of a name for myself and continue to do so. But I was going to the youth club at my local church at the time, and one of my youth leaders heard about one of my songs, and he said, "I don't understand, when you come to youth, you're such a good guy, you're positive, we know your family, and you're rapping about, you know, girls, guns and drugs, but you don't do drugs, you don't have a gun, and you don't get any girls. So why don't you write some lyrics about, you know, your faith and the journey that you're on with God, and more positive themes?" And he kind of inspired me to put that into my music, and I've been doing that ever since.
Amazing. Again, somebody saying something to you, how that had a huge impact on your life.
That's, yeah, amazing. I think I've been very blessed in my life to have people around me that can say significant things to me at significant moments. My mum always used to say this saying growing up, and she said it takes a village to raise a child. And I think by that she just means that, you know, it's the parents' job to help a child thrive, but also the youth leader, the church, the shopkeeper, the next door neighbor, all these people can have positive impact on young people. And that's certainly my story.
And clearly your parents had a strong faith, but how did that become real to you?
Well, faith is actually something I've never struggled with. I've always believed in God. I remember being young. It doesn't take much, but I used to look at both my hands and think, oh, they're the same size. An accident. I think someone's created this. And I would look at like the beauty of nature and stuff. And I just always believed that there was a mastermind behind it. I think my struggle was church and what it means to be a Christian and live out your faith. That was always what I battled with. But I think through discipleship, again, people in my life that would take me under their wing and read the Bible with me and pray with me and help seek God with me, that's what made a real difference. But I never really struggled to believe.
And what does it mean to you now, your faith?
My faith is everything now. I think growing up, it was something that I did because I thought I had to, because of the family that I came from. But now, you know, after various traumatic situations in my life of, you know, a friend getting murdered on my estate to losing my dad and losing a few friends, my faith, amongst being the foundation of how I live my life, it's my only chance of seeing those people again. It gives me a hope for the future. It shows me that it's not the end, like death is not the end, sadness is not the end, but Jesus has this all planned out and all things will work together for the good of those who love him. So for me, it's as valuable to me as, you know, breath in my lungs, it's everything.
You're married to Emma, lovely Emma. How has marriage been for you?
It's been interesting. I thought it would be a breeze. And my first year, a few friends that I spoke to said, oh, my first year was terrible. And then it got better after that. But our first year was actually amazing. And then I think after the first year, the cracks started to show. And I think my main, the main thing that I found challenging was I really struggled to communicate. And I come from a family that didn't communicate that well. And there was a lot of love in my family, but communication was pretty non-existent. And Emma comes from a family that, you know, sit around a table, 7:30, have dinner together, discuss their day. They're really good at communication. And so I think that was tough for Emma, the fact that I would, I don't know, put a work thing in one week and not let her know till the day, where I wouldn't be able to explain how my day went properly and that kind of stuff. And so it's something I've had to really work on. And I'm still on that journey because I've spent, you know, got married at 26 and I've spent the 26 years of my life being a certain way. Now, hopefully I'm going to spend another 26 trying to recalibrate my brain. But all in all, it's been a huge blessing. I think my favorite thing about marriage is, someone said this to me, it's like alone you go faster, but together you go further. And it's cool to know that, you know, God's with me everywhere I go, but also I have, you know, my person on earth to do life with, and we're in this together.
Yeah, and you have gorgeous little Ezra.
Yeah.
Has that changed things, being a father?
Yeah, definitely. I think he's given me more purpose. You know, when I look at my parents and the stuff that they did well, and now that I've taken on, and also the stuff that they didn't do so well, which is stuff that I want to improve on, I realize that Ezra is an extension of that. And he's like a sponge. I mean, the other day, he saw me brushing my teeth, and he just picked up like a pencil and started going like this. And it was just a symbol of he's watching everything I do. Yeah. And so I'm not just trying to be, you know, a good servant of Jesus, a good husband, but now I'm trying to be a good father. And, you know, at the moment I'm his hero. And so he's going to be watching everything. And it's just giving me added purpose to try my best to serve my family in the best way and serve Jesus in the best way.
Mm. I mean, your father was like a hero to you. And that was a really tough thing for you, wasn't it?
Yeah. So he passed away when I was 27. And, you know, I had lost a few people up until that point, but no one that close. And it was really sudden. He had cancer. It's called lymphoma, but he didn't know that he had it. And by the time he went to the hospital, he had passed away a few days later. And I think up until that point, you know, I had been conditioned that, you know, men don't cry and stiff upper lip and that kind of stuff. And also culturally, I'm the eldest child. And so a lot of the responsibility is, you know, I assume responsibility in these kind of situations. And so I tried my best to be strong after my dad passed away and be there for my mom and be this man that society tells me I have to be. And I think I just reached emotional and mental capacity, and I ended up breaking down on a beach in Newport. I was on tour with Matt Redman 3 months later, and I said, I'm just popping out some fresh air. And I felt really heavy that day. And yeah, I was just in floods of tears on the beach. But interestingly, after I had finished crying, I felt this freedom that I hadn't felt for a long time. And that's when I started to realize that actually maybe, you know, God is okay with me being vulnerable and being emotional and externalizing some of the things that have been pent up for a long time. But yeah, my dad passing away was just a real awakening for me. And it helps me reshape my masculinity and how I deal with my emotions and communicate my feelings.
And what are you learning? Because, you know, we've talked and we both into counselling and therapy and all that kind of stuff. And you've talked quite openly about that. Just say what difference that's made for you.
Yeah, I think counselling has always been a bit taboo in my family, because I think in Ghanaian culture, if you see a counsellor, it's almost like an embarrassment to the family because you're admitting that things aren't in order. And so I had to do some reconditioning, and I realized that I need practice and help in terms of communicating. So I went to see someone, first person I actually didn't get on with that well. And I just thought, after 10 minutes, what am I doing here? I found someone else, and they were great. And I ended up, you know, talking about things that I had never openly expressed before. And I'm not saying I walked out of counseling and everything was fine, but I walked really heavy. And when I walked out, I felt a lot lighter. And it made me realize that it's sometimes good to externalize how you feel. I don't think that God put human beings on earth so that we could go through life alone. I think that he helps us first and foremost, but he has also equipped professionals to help us as well. And we should make use of that when we can. So that was huge for me. Counseling was big for me.
And how are you processing that grief now? Because it's a few years on now, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's about 3 years on now. And I think a few people have said some poignant things that have helped. One of them was in a book by Levi Lusco. It's called Through the Eyes of a Lion. And he spoke about perspective as a Christian. And, you know, for me, every Father's Day or every birthday that went by, I'd get really upset and down because it felt like my dad was getting further and further away. But switching my perspective, I realized that as a Christian, and my dad was a Christian also, God's prepared a place for him. And every year that goes by, I'm actually getting closer and closer to seeing him again. So things are still bittersweet, but there's joy at the end of it. And that's really helped me. And another thing is not to see grief or overcoming grief as a destination. I always used to think, wow, when am I going to get over this? But I don't know if I ever will. I just think I'll learn to live with it a little better, and I'll be better equipped as time goes on. And there'll be great days, but sometimes I might be down, and you know, storms might come. I might have to ride some waves, but Jesus is with me in all of that, and I'm not alone. And so, yeah, those things have really helped. And yeah, I think just seeing my dad, because I was, you know, thankfully there on the day that he passed away, and you know, seeing his body and stuff. I just thought, ah, oh, you've lived for 58 years and all you've done is worked hard and not really enjoyed the fruits of your labor. But it spoke to me that, you know, life is fragile and we can't really go through it worrying what other people think. We have to try our best to do what God put us on this earth to do and recognize the seasons and just try our best to do the best we can with what we have. And then it's not a life wasted. And for me, you know, my dad's life wasn't wasted because he poured so much into me. And I'm sure he's proud of, you know, Ezra, his grandson, and all that we're doing. So, yeah, that was kind of a long answer, but hopefully.
No, it's a good answer.
Great answer. Isaac, you're passionate about youth, and I know that the youth clubs, when you were at that age, made a huge impact on your life. What do you feel is going on, and what are you doing at the moment with youth?
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, like we've spoken about, my head teacher, my youth leaders, they had a huge impact on me, but you know, since 2010, there was about 1.4 billion put into the youth sector in the form of youth clubs and youth workers. We're in, you know, 2021 now, and that's been probably a third of that budget remaining being put into youth services. Around 5,000 youth leaders have lost their jobs. Youth clubs are pretty much non-existent. And trying to think, where do these young people go who are investing in their lives? What do we do about that? It always strikes me when people are surprised in, you know, half terms and summer holidays when knife crime is on the up and violence is increasing. And for me, it makes sense because these young people have nowhere to go. They have no role models in their lives. They have no one speaking into them. And of course, there's parents that have a responsibility in the education system and that. But I actually think that we need to try and provide homes for young people. And we need to, even if it's not called a youth club, I think the church has a role to play in this. How are we really doing outreach and helping to make young people feel like there's a safe space for them and there's an alternative and they don't just have to hang around on the streets getting up to no good. And so I think there's work to be done. I am excited because I feel like the church has a huge opportunity to pioneer something in this space. I think if you're from a working class community, you learn to not rely on the government too much. You learn that they will try to do what they know that they think they should be doing, but ultimately the impetus is with the people to make something happen. And I think there's an exciting opportunity here. And yeah, I think it's tough for young people at the moment.
That's interesting. If you're involved in leading young people at the moment, what, Isaac, would you say people need to be doing at this time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, for me, well, I heard this quote once. I always go back to quotes that I hear. I'm not sure who I heard it from, but like, young people don't care what you know until they know that you care. And, you know, that was my story. The reason why what Miss Arnonson said to me meant so much is because I knew she cared about me. She spotted talent, and my youth leader, I knew that he cared about me. And I think we have to show that we really care about the individual. Like, so many times we just lump young people into this box, but it's actually, let's learn to see the one, you know, what makes the individual tick and how can we have impact on their lives. The other thing I'd say is sometimes as leaders, we can feel like we have to have all the answers, but I don't know if you realize, but young people's questions are getting harder and harder to answer. And so you actually don't have to have all the answers. You just have to be willing to journey with people and work it out together. And so I think young people are just getting so good at smelling when something isn't authentic. You know, there's so much access to information. Social media is littered with all this info and stuff. And so I think if you're leading young people, the authenticity is more important than knowing everything. Don't be ashamed to say, I don't know, but we can work it out together. You know, they're not impressed by your knowledge. They're probably more impressed by how you treat them, more impressed by your authenticity, you're more impressed by your honesty. So I think, yeah, authenticity over impressing young people with how much you know. Don't be ashamed to say you don't know. Journey with them.
That's very good, yeah.
It's so helpful having Google. Because when our eldest son, Henry, was three, or even probably even below three, he started asking why. Everything was why. And it was like, there were such complicated questions. And we never knew what to say. Now, Henry's living with us, and he's got a three-year-old. And he keeps asking why. But now, hey, now he's learnt to say, okay, Google, why?
Yeah. My dad would often make up an answer as the truth, and then I'd go back to school and say, well, my dad said this, and my teacher would be like, well, your dad's wrong.
And what do you think young people need at the moment? There's a sort of crisis for young people. What do you think they need to do? Where can they find help and hope?
Anything that represents a safe space, I think, you know, safe space, safe environment at home that's safe. If they haven't got that, then, you know, a safe group of friends that they can be honest with. If they haven't got that, then, you know, at church, a safe space with leaders that they trust. I think safety is the number one, because there's a lot of fear in life. Like, fear is coming at us from different directions, and young people are struggling with, you know, thoughts that aren't helpful and their mental health and their emotional health. And so anything or any person that can make them feel truly safe is really important. I think that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think fear is so bad in this generation?
It's all around, you know. Death is all around us. We switch on the news and there's bad news all around us. People are fearful of their futures. You know, these news headlines, you can't get a house if you're a young person anymore, or there's not enough jobs, or employment rate's really low. There's just not a lot of good news. But as Christians, we know that there is, and we have to be leaders in this area because we actually have the good news. And yeah, I think fear is all around, and we have to combat that with faith.
Now, another area that we've spoken about before, and you've had a real impact on our church and in the conversations, is the whole area of the response, I guess, the killing of George Floyd and that this whole issue of racism. And I love a quote in your book where you quote the ex-American basketball player Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I hope I pronounced his right name right. He said, but this is an amazing quote to me, racism is like dust in the air. It seems invisible, even if you're choking on it, until you let the sun in, then you see it's everywhere. And it seems like kind of this year, it's been a year when we've let the sun in and you can see it's everywhere. And I know you've experienced it, because you've given account of one time when you're driving, where you get kind of, I think you said that Emma's never been stopped for her driving. You've been stopped 15 times. Are you a terrible driver? Do you drive like 100 miles an hour in the 30 mile an hour zone?
If we're talking about driving skill, I think it's a wonder that Emma has never been stopped. But yeah, Emma's never been stopped in her car by police. And I remember talking to her when we first started dating, and at that point I had been stopped around 15 times. Now, one of them, I was driving a bit fast, so we can push that with my foot. But the other 14 times, it was just, you know, you've matched the description of someone that we're looking for. Can we stop? And it's not just can we stop you, it's what have you got in your boot? Can we look in your compartment? Are you insured? Whose car is this? And all those questions, though seem valid, like the quote that you just read, they're kind of contained in unconscious bias, because, you know, I'm sure Emma at some point has matched the description of a criminal, but she's never been stopped. She's never been asked if she's insured on a car. She's never been asked if the car is hers. And yeah, that quote just basically says that if you get to the root of why some of these things are happening, there's unconscious bias. It's because a policeman might view a young black male as a threat or as a criminal, even though they might not deem themselves to be racist. And yeah. I think that's what that quote is saying.
But you, there's one incident where you actually got an apology, didn't you?
Yeah, so I was filming a music video and one of my camera guys put this long kind of black bag in the boot, and someone from the area apparently had phoned the police saying, I've just seen, you know, two black guys putting guns in the boot of a car. And so it was in Tottenham and the police hailed us for a bit, and I kind of saw it in my rearview mirror. I thought, this doesn't look too good. And as we turned the corner, about eight policemen with guns pointing at us, shouting, get out of the car, get out of the car, get out of the car. And so obviously we didn't know what was going on. We got out and they searched the boot and saw that it was camera equipment. Now I completely understand that there was a threat that they thought was there and someone had called saying it was guns, etc. But I was more upset with the fact that they didn't explain to us this. It was just kind of, all right guys, you're good to go, thanks, see you later. And so I wrote a letter of complaint to the IPCC, just explaining what had happened, and received an apology, because it's not protocol. When police stop you, they're meant to give you a reason why, they're meant to give you a slip and all these things, and that didn't happen.
But Isaac, one thing I love about you is you're very balanced in your view, because you're not like anti-police, are you?
Oh, no, of course not. You know, I have friends, in-laws that are police officers, and I think I'm mature enough to know that the police as an institution, they're not all bad, you know. But I think police, music, all these different things, they're a reflection of society and they're made up of people, and people are imperfect. Some people have unconscious bias and this is played out in their work. And I think with the police thing, some of their decisions have very real consequences. And so that's why it needs to be highlighted. But I'm not at all saying that, you know, all policemen are bad and racist or anything like that. I'm just saying that we have to look at the root of why decisions are made, who are targeted, and why we're targeting these people.
And what do you feel right now? I mean, this year has been a real year of exposing and everyone trying to get it right. And what are you feeling about all these issues now?
So I think the overriding feeling is, you know, the pandemic has essentially stopped the world. And so I always say, I don't think that the George Floyd incident would have been as monumental if we weren't in a pandemic and people were going about their daily lives. Everyone stopped what they're doing. And because of that, we have people's attention. And I think that when we have people's attention, two things can happen. We can be divided, or we can use this opportunity to unite. And I think if we want to use this opportunity to unite, two things, truth and grace. We have to use this opportunity to highlight some truths that may be, you know, quite serious, quite difficult to talk about, but we have to approach these conversations with grace, because ultimately my dream is for all of us to be united, for all of us to be on the same team, and for all of us to try and be on the same page and do God's work here on earth. So I think this is a great opportunity for difficult conversations to happen and for us to move forward, but we have to approach these conversations with grace. And also one thing I will say is, you know, I think it's my hope for the church to be leaders in a lot of these areas.
Yeah.
I think it would be great if the world can reflect what the church is leading in and not the other way around. And I think with George Floyd, we'll openly admit that, you know, some of that stuff, the church was late to the party. But I think that we're playing catch up now, and we're serious on the most part. And it's a great opportunity for us to rally together and model unity, model love, model grace, model, you know, what Jesus would want to see here on earth. But I think the opportunity is huge.
People say that you're a role model and you're talking about modeling things. How do you feel about that? Is that a huge responsibility? And
I wouldn't call myself a role model. I come from a very normal, like, background, humble beginnings. I just want to see young people thrive and reach their full potential. I have huge, I think a lot of us have it a little bit, imposter syndrome of when I get asked to do stuff like this and the TV stuff. I don't feel particularly qualified or intellectual, but I just think I carry love that Jesus has given to me, and I carry and empathy, because I know how easy it is for people to go in the wrong direction. For example, I got handed that gun at 11 through no choice of my own. It was just provided to me, and a wrong decision, my life could have gone a completely different way. So I know how easy it is to go the wrong way as a young person. And so, yeah, I'm not a role model. I just want to help people.
Yeah, I think you're a very good role model, actually. And the fact you don't think you're a role model is part of being a role model. It's, yeah. You don't really want role models who think they're role models. That's the worst thing. No, you're a great role model.
Yes.
And talk a bit about culture, because your music is so important to culture. And what are you trying to achieve in your music, and how can we have an impact on culture?
Yeah, for me, when you talk about culture, it's such a big word with so much nuance. But for me, my definition is it's just the way we do things around here. And I think we have to change the way we do things, you know, in music, you know, rap music, hip hop music cannot continue to be just known for misogyny and violence and antisocial behavior. That shouldn't be the way that we do things. And so my heart is to fill it with love and the truth of Jesus and friendship and how to deal with grief and all these kind of things. But essentially, I think we have to get our culture from what's modeled in the Bible, how Jesus tells us to live. It's there. I feel like that should be our guidebook to how we set culture. But it's so hard to change because, you know, so many things go to culture. It comes from upbringing, it comes from class, it comes from, you know, all these different things. And I think a good way forward is, and I always tell my friends this, we're going to come across so many different people that are not like us. Key thing to try and do is to find common ground. What do we have in common? And let's build from there, you know? But yeah, culture is a big way. And I just think we need to think about the way we do things. And we have to do things with love, with grace, with truth, and all the things that we've spoken about.
And you're doing that. I mean, you're doing like so much TV stuff, BBC, Sky Sports, loads of opportunities for you to speak into the culture.
Yeah, it's great. And I think the most exciting thing about the Sky Sports thing is that, you know, I can finally share that, you know, Pips and Nikki are West Ham fans.
Absolutely. West Ham.
Which division are they in?
Oh, come on, Nikki, you're having a laugh, mate. in the Premier League. But yeah, no, it's a blessing to be able to do these things. I think, you know, when I was younger, I always saw purpose as, oh, God wants us to do like this one thing that he's put us here for, and that's what we need to do. But I don't know, I kind of view, you know, God's purpose for mankind a bit more fluid. I think it's less about what we do. So you can only be a rapper or you can only be a presenter. I think it's more about who we are and our character and whether we're showing Jesus in every one of these areas that we're operating in. So yeah, I've kind of changed my view on what purpose looks like.
Mm. Another thing that's really happened this week is the murder of Sarah Everard and the impact that's having on women in particular. Mm. What's your take on what's happening in the culture right now on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, as I said before, the world stopped and some issues that are super important issues that maybe haven't been given the attention that they deserve being brought to the forefront. And I think it's an important conversation to have. In all of these issues, you know, women's equality, Sarah Everard, George Floyd, I think we as individuals need to, you know, rather than passing the buck, because we're good at doing that, saying, well, the government passed this law and that kind of stuff. I think all that structural stuff needs to happen. But ultimately, we need to look in the mirror and think, how can we take responsibility and positively impact the issues at play? So for me, it's, am I doing anything in life that is ignorant towards women? Or is there a way that in which I can increase equality towards women in my life and what I do? And if there is, then I have to do that. I think, you know, ultimately, it's not women's fault that society or men view them in this way, or that men can be predatory and all that kind of stuff. It's not black people's fault that racism exists. And so I think it shouldn't be left to women or black people to deal with these issues. I think all of us have to chip in and ask, how can we help? But so often it's like, oh, inequality towards women, we'll just let women deal with that, or racism, we'll just let black people deal with that. And I don't think that's the way it should be. I think men should take responsibility in the women conversation. And I think, you know, people from other races should take responsibility in the race conversation.
Hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. How does Emma feel in this season?
She's not here at the moment. I always feel nervous when I have to speak on her behalf. But yeah, I think, you know, the mood of the nation is that, and I think Emma would say this as well, all you have to do is switch on the news and there's another problem every other day. And it's like, as a Christian, what is our role to play in this? How can God use us in these situations? And I think Emma and myself were just asking us every day, like, Lord, use us. We don't want to be bystanders because that's almost, it's complicit, you know? You're just saying, well, it's happening and I'm fine with that. We want to be active and we want to be allies. And yeah, I think we're just looking for opportunities and ways in which God can use us. You'll probably say that a lot better than I just said it. So you have to speak to her.
Well, we will. And do you have hope for the future? Hope for the church? Hope for young people?
100%. I have hope because I have Jesus. And Jesus is hope. There's always, you know, there's a hope and a future he has planned out. We just have to decide what part of history do we want to be on? Do we want our children and our grandchildren to read about Sarah Everett and George Floyd and ask, Dad, what did you do? And you're just there saying, oh, I did nothing. I don't want that, because I know Ezra's going to ask me. You know, I always, you know, the books that we used to read in school and stuff. And it was so easy as a child to say, why didn't anyone do anything? But yeah, Living in the moment, we can realize how easy it is to just go through life and not really stand up for anything. I have huge hope, and that's why I can smile, because I know that, you know, Jesus, the victory is already his. We just have to play our part.
Mm. And how important is music in that?
I think music's an outlet. I think it's part of a wider story. I think any way in which God has given us an outlet to express ourselves, whether it's through, you know, leading a church like you both do, or music like I do, or, you know, having a conversation later with a guy called Mark Roper, who's in Life of the Church, who's a doctor, a lady called Rachel Woolridge, who's a theologian. I think we all have a part to play. God's given us all something unique. And, you know, there's that verse, I can't remember where it is now, but you guys probably know more about your Bible than I do. But it's where, well, I think it's Corinthians. We're all part of the same body, but we play different parts, you know. And I think music is just one of those parts, but it needs the whole body to be able to be productive and work.
Brilliant.
Is it Corinthians? Did I get that right?
Yes.
1 Corinthians, yeah.
You're impressive, Isaac. You're impressive.
So good. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. And yes. Miss Aronson was absolutely right.
Obviously a prodigy at 7.
I know. She probably said it to quite a few other kids. I know something from everyone. So.
I don't believe it.
A big thank you to Isaac for joining us this week. I love his passion and commitment to reaching the next generation. Okay, you do not want to miss this next episode. We are digging into the archives to share a conversation Nikki had with Cardinal Louis Tagle at Leadership Conference in 2017. In all my years of attending the Leadership Conference, this has got to be one of my favorite interviews. Cardinal Tagle was the Archbishop of Manila from 2011 to 2020 and is currently living in Rome, working as the prefect of the Congregation for the Evangelization of Peoples. He's also the president of the charity Caritas, which exists to end poverty and promote justice in over 200 countries and territories. We are looking forward to sharing this conversation with you. And speaking of the Leadership Conference, we're excited to announce that we're offering this year's conference online for free. And there are two different times to choose from, on May 4th or 5th. We're looking forward to gathering online in this way and to have the opportunity to encounter God and to grow in our leadership together. You can register today at leadershipconference.org.uk. Well, that's all from me today. please join us in 2 weeks' time for Nikki's conversation with Cardinal Tagle. We'll see you soon.